This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All is well.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. So today's show, we are talking about, it's titled Finding Your Dream Job and Some Drama at Work. So we're going to talk about some questions that we've had from listeners on that topic. Mm-hmm. And speaking of work drama and dream jobs, I was reading a study. It was an article recently that came out in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And this was a study, actually it was 8 studies done out of Duke's Fuqua Business University. And the study was called Understanding Contemporary Forms of Exploitation. Attributions of Passion Served to Legitimize the Poor Treatment of Workers. And the name of the article in Duke University that was published in the news was called Love Your Job, Someone May Be Taking Advantage of You. So this reminded me of Dr. Lyle, your exploration, the sucker triad. So we are going to go over, there was 8 studies done in this major study, in this larger study, this research. So we're going to go over a little bit. I'll try to make it as brief as possible. And then we can talk about the sucker triad. Dr. Lyle, get your thoughts on this whole, all these studies, and then we'll get to the listener questions. So in study number one, this was the researchers tested for something called passion exploitation at an occupational level. And they were trying to explore whether people are more likely to legitimize exploiting workers from professions that are more strongly associated with passion. So things like artists and social workers were going to be what they call professions associated with passion. And the other 6 studies, they manipulated levels of the target workers' passion. And then they investigated whether people would view exploitative treatment targeted at a strongly passionate target as more legitimate versus exploitative treatment targeted at a weakly passionate person. And then they explored whether this effect is mediated by the expectations that workers with a strong passion would actually voluntarily work longer and harder and consider work in a passionate field to be its own reward. So then they had a meta-analysis, which is a analysis of several studies of these 8 experimental studies, and then 2 replications of the 3rd study. And they tested how robust the effect of the passion manipulation was on legitimizing the exploiting of the target worker. So across the studies, they also controlled for several potential alternative explanations and confounding variables, like someone who was perceived more friendly, so perceived friendliness of the target worker, that was in a few of the studies, perceived confidence, competence and liking of the target worker, and then perceived pay, perceived status, and perceived importance to the community across different level of occupations. And then they also examined whether or not legitimization of passion exploitation extends beyond jobs that are associated with passion. So that would be like consulting or a store clerk or a high school teacher, flight attendant. And then they also studied the effect in an actual work study, work setting and an actual academic setting, and then outside of the work setting. And so in the final 2 studies, studies 7 and 8.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, this was it was really detailed, and so I mean, it was a really interesting. They had interesting, compilation of these studies. They attempted to connect passional expectation to justice motives more directly in the 7th study, and then they assessed whether people are more likely to presume that exploited workers are passionate, and whether this is moderated by people who have what they called a BJW, which stands for a belief in the just world. Mm-hmm. And then in the final study, study number 8, they tested whether the belief in a just world moderates the tendency to legitimize poor treatment of passionate workers by presuming that they would have freely chosen this work.
Right.
And so these studies introduce the idea of some what they called passion exploitation, and then demonstrate mm-hmm. the logic that people use to legitimize it. And so this would mm-hmm. be, they would ask workers to stay later than they would need to, or do demeaning jobs. So for example, they would ask a worker who is out at a family barbecue at a park to say, "Oh, by the way, come back. The office bathroom needs to be cleaned." And they would mm-hmm. see whether or not someone would actually be willing to do that, or if they would do extra unpaid work. So mm-hmm. they actually found that all of these all these studies found that it in fact is true that if you are passionate about what you do, people may see, or your employer may see this as a legitimate reason, and other people may see this as a legitimate reason to exploit you. So mm-hmm. you know, the researchers did say that the research is not intended to be seen as anti-passion. They just want people to know that they shouldn't let that finding passion in the world also comes with in the work also comes with the human tendency to legitimize or ignore the exploitation that comes with that.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I'm just curious, did you see anything in here about the identification of the personality variables, conscientiousness, and agreeable?
No, that was what's cool.
Yeah,
they're
totally blind. So this is an example of this. So this was done in the business school at Duke.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So this is an example of the a lack of cross-pollinization, where some business school researchers wind up, you know, looking at a problem that interests them, which is fine, but they didn't manage to cross the street and go to talk to anybody in the psychology department, particularly somebody in the field of personality that would have told them, "Hey guys, all you're really looking at here is conscientiousness and agreeableness. That's it. That's what you're looking at." Okay. So we didn't have to, we're just talking about the exploitation of conscientiousness and agreeableness. And along with it, what we're seeing is not – we're seeing also something else that they're making a big fuss about, which is moderately interesting. But we can analyze this pretty easily here, which is that if you do – you exploit people who you can exploit, in this case, the conscientious and agreeable person, and it feels fair to you because you can see that – they are more willing to do it. Okay. So in other words, they're not giving you the pushback that someone else is giving you. And so as a result of that, it makes sense that you would infer that it is fair. And so they can look at some of the little interesting cognitive elements that are going to go on depending upon the circumstances of the particular individuals in a particular study. Like, well, they're in a more passionate field, more passion driven field, so that they would really love their work, blah, 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 blah. But the main effect here is the following. And that is that high conscientious people are going to be much more, quote, exploited. Now, also, I would take issue to a certain extent with their language. They're being very confident about the concept of exploitation. Let's understand why the highly conscientious person is more willing to do those things. The reason is that high conscientiousness is by definition an overestimation of the worst case scenario on average. It isn't that they aren't sometimes right. Sometimes they predict that, you know, the tiles are going to come off the shuttle and they were right and everybody else was wrong. But in general, with respect to, you know, an entire universe of normal social interaction processes and human risk analysis, the average person is about right about figuring out whether Aunt Millie is going to leave you if you do that, she's not going to leave you in her will. Okay. So the average person has pretty good intuition about these things. The hyper-conscientious person is going to overkill it. That's why they're, that's why they are not as, that's why that gene is not as numerous in the gene pool, because they're over-investing in the worst case scenario, and effectively they're wasting their time and energy, and they're not producing as much DNA as effectively as someone who isn't as conscientious. So therefore, what this means is, or the subjective phenomenology of the person's experience being a highly conscientious person is anxiety. It's like, oh, I'm going to lose my job. Okay. Or people are going to think badly of me. So as a result, so what's happening is that if they get asked to do extra things, it's a relief for them. It's like, yes, of course I will. Okay. So in other words, if they said no, they would be very anxious. It would increase their anxiety. So they're overkilling. So the idea that they're both, quote, being exploited is, it's true in one, from one perspective, but from the second perspective, you have to understand that that individual is pre-wired to not have any choice in this regard, that they're essentially, all things being equal, they're going to need to do a better job than average just to feel like they're at an average level of safety in the pack. That's because they're misperceiving the realities of the situation and the risk that they're under for being kicked out of the village. So, of course, it would make sense not just for employers to recognize this, but everybody, okay? Everybody recognizes the high conscientious person. Now, the high conscientious person who's disagreeable isn't going to be so easy, okay? Because they're high conscientious and they're worried about the worst case scenario doesn't mean that they're that easily to be exploited, because they have a countermanding estimation where they feel like what's fair is actually not fair. It's actually weighted in their own direction if they're disagreeable. So as a result, with respect to a typical business situation and overtime situation, these two different aspects of the personality would be pushing against each other, and you would wind up somewhere in the middle of the bell curve. Okay, now, so really it requires not just high conscientiousness, it also requires at least average level of agreeability, or you can imagine, folks, if we were to look at this as a two-factor algebra problem, it's literally what's your percentile on your conscientiousness versus what's your percentile on your agreeableness, and we're just going to work those against each other. And of course, obviously, the person's individual situation is interesting in every individual instance. It's not from the standpoint of science, but how much money do they have in the bank? What's their situation with spouse or support? What's their situation with parental support? How many kids are they feeding? Have they been, quote, traumatized by the fact that they lost their job 4 years ago and didn't get a job for a year and a half? These are all the idiosyncratic variables that are acting on the individual's CV. But all those washing out being equal across all parties, what counts is conscientiousness and agreeableness.
Mm-hmm.
And either one of those can be exploited. Okay. So high agreeable, moderate conscientious can absolutely be exploited. And high conscientiousness, average agreeableness can be exploited. And high conscientiousness, high agreeable can be murdered. Okay. And that's what's going to happen. But they are doing so because the person on the other side of it is going to agree to this because of their anxiety that is as a result of overestimating the worst case scenario. So yeah, mm-hmm. So these folks did a bunch of interesting stuff. And what they didn't know was that their whole schmo could be boiled down to two personality variables sitting right in the middle of the big five.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Perhaps in future studies, they can just have every subject just fill out the big five, the BF10, and then use that for later.
Yeah.
At first, I thought when I was reading the study, I thought, you know, maybe it's that the people who are most passionate about their work are going to be feeling so over rewarded that they don't want to lose the job and therefore this. But they accounted for that in the study number 3, 5, and 6 when they are a study, I believe, 2, 3, and 7 where they changed the jobs around to something that nobody could really be passionate about, like being a store clerk or other types of things.
Right.
And,
Yeah, the truth is that another interesting thing that they're looking at is that when you exploit people that don't give you pushback on being exploited, it feels reasonably fair, i.e. the just world. Okay, so it's like, wow, that's just kind of how it is. So, gee, Karen, can you stay late? It's like, I ask Karen because she's very likely to say yes. Mm-hmm. And it feels okay then. I didn't really push her that hard. And so therefore it must not have been that unfair. Okay. Whereas if I ask Judy and Judy's like, no way, not a chance in hell. My contract says I'm out of here at 5 o'clock. It's like, well, I only have to ask her once. And the truth is I already know that that's what I'm going to get from her before I ever asked her, because she signaled that disagreeableness all down the line in 100 other transactions. So mm-hmm. Yeah, this is these characteristics are quite readable and therefore quite exploitable. Absolutely.
That's fantastic. So finding your dream job includes finding someone who is recognizes that you're, you know, where your level of conscientiousness is, so that they don't give you too much work that you feel burnt out, and they compensate you appropriately, and they don't give you not enough work so you don't feel like you're contributing. Is that about accurate?
Oh, I don't know. The dream job is you do something that you find really interesting that you like to do, and that the social situation and the power situation around it is reasonable. Okay, that's as good as it gets. So when it's unreasonable, when there are difficult, unreasonable, exploitative humans above you, life's going to be miserable. If you've got reasonable people above you, then life's going to be fine. So yeah, you do what you, if you can afford to pursue what it is that you really like to do, then the next move is the social ecology of where you do it, just like the rest of your life. The social ecology of your life, i.e. who your friends are and who your mate is, these are the key elements as to how enjoyable your life is. And the same thing is going to be true precisely when it comes to your work situation.
Fascinating. All right, so our first question from one of our listeners this evening is the following. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm halfway through getting a master's in public health. I'm not motivated by the content, and I have a personality where I need to do my best and can't settle for anything below an A, so it's extra hard. The only reason I'm getting a master in public health is just in case some magic job in the future requires it, even though right now I'm content at my job. I would get a small 3% raise with my master's. So the question I have is, do I finish, which will take me 3 years at a slow pace, or just quit now? I constantly dream about the free time and free space in my head I would get if I quit.
All right. Really good question. And I would say the following. The person has it analyzed quite well. And the reason why they're kind of in the trap is we're looking at a very high conscientious individual who is preparing for some theoretical possibility in the future that's not even very likely. And because of the high C, you know, they're not willing to just go through and do a mediocre job and just get a degree so they've got it on their diploma. No, the high C dictates that they actually have to do a really good job. So it's not worth the this isn't worth the trouble. So this is a bad cost-benefit analysis. And we can tell because the right brain is screaming the answer to this person. It's screaming, don't do it. We ought to be lying down on the chaise lounge eating grapes. Don't do it. We ought to be playing, you know, I don't know, badminton. We ought to be doing something else. We shouldn't be doing this. Okay, so take a cue. This individual, like I said, looks to be very high C, master's of public health. They probably got an advanced degree in nursing or something of that nature. So they're probably pretty darn secure, and they're just looking to angle at some level up theoretically in the future. And the truth is that and master's of public health isn't necessarily a very powerful weapon in that regard. If it ever becomes obvious that that's something that you burn for, go back and do it later. But for now, quit. That's what I would say. You got plenty of right brain data telling you to do it.
Fascinating. You know, Dr. Lyle, one thing I really love about your approach is that you're not afraid to say, hey, just quit. Whereas so many people are so concerned with the status of getting the master's that they'll end up wasting a lot of time.
Oh yeah. That's just a waste of life. Forget it. Some theoretical, foggy, very questionable benefit out there lurking in the future somewhere isn't a good enough reason to deny yourself what the right brain is screaming, which is the freedom that comes from not having this essentially useless burden hanging over your head. So the evidence is in. It's telling her or him all that the person needs to do is listen to the right brain. The right brain is coming up with the answer, which it very often does. I can't tell you how many people have told me after their divorce, you know, I knew the day I was married. I knew it was a mistake. Okay. The right brain knew it was absolutely, you know, plenty crystal clear, and they did it anyway behind some competing demands and the fact that invitations had been sent and et cetera, and all the expectations and push from other people. But they had it down in them that they were making the wrong move. And so, you know, you want to honor that. You want to be listening to and paying attention to why your, what I call the right brain, or just your holistic sort of overall integrated assessment that comes as an emotional tone when you're considering something. That's, you know, that's really worth listening to. Very often the right brain knows before the left brain can analytically and articulately tell us why. And sometimes it can never tell us. Sometimes you can't say why you don't like, you know, cilantro. You just don't. And that's how that works.
I knew we were going to hit cilantro one way or the other.
Yeah, we're going to hit it sooner or later. It's coming back around.
Unless Heidi Klum is offering it to you, Dr. Lyle, I think you're going to be set without cilantro.
There you go. Now it's a different issue. All right.
Our next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I received a demotion and a large pay cut last year, not due to performance, but because the new employment director wanted to, quote, flatten the organization. I had one direct report, but now we are peers. I want my attitude to be better and not care too much about this, but I find I'm being passive aggressive in situations, and I'd like to shake that. I'm disabled as well, so that makes just looking for another job a little tricky. I feel stuck, but something has to change. What say you?
Okay. What's happening is that the person is angry, and they're angry because it feels unfair. And then when you're not sure, because you feel boxed in and you're not in a position of power about something that looks unfair, then that's when you get passive aggressive. So the fundamental issue is the concept of fairness. And so, of course, anger is all about fairness. That's the fundamental process of anger. It's a feeling that involves a social signal to tell people on the other side of a conflict of interest that they're treating you unfairly. Okay, and you would like to threaten them, but with the dissolution of the relationship or other consequences. So you can, this is what I call the axis of fairness. And if you can think of a line segment with down the middle of the line segment, think of a horizontal line segment down the middle of it is what we call the axis of fairness. On the far left would be anger, and on the far right would be guilt. And so anger and guilt are the mirror images of each other. So anger is essentially the statement that says you're treating me unfairly, and I'm going to impose consequences on you for this if you continue. And guilt is the feeling that says, oh, I'm so sorry that I've apparently treated you unfairly. Let me give you a concession to make up for it. So this is these are twin adaptations. And so so this person is feeling, quote, passive aggressive, which means that they are somewhere on the anger side of the graph. There's probably 80 words that go from the middle of the graph out to anger, irritation, frustration, et cetera. But they're angry. Okay. That's what we would call it in simplistic terms. And there's reasons for that. So there, you know, the dominance hierarchy has been disturbed in a way that's unsettling. Essentially, they've been brought down in the dominance hierarchy by bringing a peer up to their level. The and so that's uncomfortable and feels unfair. There doesn't feel like there's adequate justification. As the person says, it's not for performance. It's other sort of reasons of restructuring for somebody's brainchild that things needed to be done differently. The and that was a mistake on the part of the person that did this, probably. In other words, you could still leave a hierarchy, even though you may have flattened things out financially. You still could have left a hierarchy in place, which would not have bothered the person underneath, provided the hierarchy was sound and reasonable. So yeah, even in places where there's 17 guys all doing the same job, the guy with the most seniority has, i.e. he's making 2% more money than the guy that was there a year after him. So there's a process by which there's a hierarchy still there, and it could have been very easy for them to maintain some kind of a hierarchical structure there, but they chose not to do that, which is a problematic and unfair feeling outcome for this individual. So whether or not they'll get used to it or not, it'll probably hang over them for a while. But a big part of when you feel like things are not fair, one of the things that we want to do is we want to investigate our alternatives. So it's not uncommon for situations to change in an existing situation. Like, for example, a starter in the NBA heads down to the bench, gets put on the bench. And that's because they're watching analytics in practice and in games, and they find that, you know what, turns out I don't think he's quite as good as the other guy. And so they're bent. And do they feel like it's unfair? Yes, they do. The natural human, in any human, there's a hint of narcissism. In other words, the human being is slightly biased, at least in terms of what it is that they think is fair. And so, of course, our starter now feels like it's unfair. And so they're irritated. And if it doesn't change, they want to be traded, and they may demand to be traded. And so now if they're traded, what can happen is they go to the next team, and it turns out that they're on the bench there. And then they're irritated, but it's not quite the same. Now they go to the next team, and they're on the bench there. And now it's like they're starting to calibrate. Okay, now it's possible if they don't have a narcissistic streak, they become calibrated to the situation, and now they're not unhappy. So happiness is the result of the feedback being consistent with your expectation of it's about what's fair, or even better than the expectations about what you think is fair. So the happiness is the result of earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter, and having that esteem signaled in a way that looks like it's commensurate with the esteem that you believe you earned. That's how that process works. So if it turns out that you don't believe you're being esteemed at the level that you would deserve, then you should be irritated, which is exactly what this person is. And so the question would be, is it true? Are you actually being shorted? And one way to find out is to shop yourself to the marketplace. So I've had people do this, and it's gone both ways. Sometimes they shop themselves to the marketplace, and they found out that indeed the market was better, the grass was greener somewhere else, and they took it. Sometimes they found out the grass was greener, and they came back and negotiated with their company, and they said, hey, the grass is greener somewhere else, but I'd like to stay here, but this is what they're offering me. Okay? I.e., take it or leave it, because if you don't give it to me, I'm leaving. All right? A third thing that can happen is you go find out that there is no better option, that you're actually sitting in the best option that there is. That can be a humbling experience, but nonetheless valuable for the person's happiness. So they can think, okay, this is kind of like, you know, you're house shopping and you think you found a pretty good house, but you also feel like maybe it's too much money. And then you go see 15 more houses and you find out, oh no, this is the best deal. Okay. And it reduces your dissonance. So what I would tell this person to do is start looking for other options. And you know, you instead of being passive aggressive, we're going to be actively aggressive. So we're going to not be just sitting there smoldering and trying to send faint little signals that we just might, you know, that we're going to either do less or that we might defect if you don't make things right, which is just a lousy feeling to be sitting in that situation. And that you can't, that's why we call it passive aggressive. And that's because you really aren't doing much threatening because you're not in a position of strength in order to do it. The right move is to go to the trouble and go to the effort to find out where you are really calibrated in the world. That's what you need to do. And once you find out, you get a better sense of where you stand with respect to the calibration problem, then you will either be motivated to renegotiate with your existing people, or, you know, under a position of power and a threat where you're going to leave otherwise, or you'll just leave, or you'll stay and you're likely to be happier. So that's the solution to that problem.
And this doesn't work with marriages or relationships though, right?
That's actually what people do. They do exactly the same thing. So if they are not happy, they are very likely to do a little shopping. Okay. That's what the flirtation process is. That's why, you know, somebody in an unhappy marriage is starting to go to lunch with people, you know, at work and shopping the market a little bit. This is precisely what people are doing. There would be no rational process otherwise. In other words, of course, this is the type of process that people would go through. You're trying to find out, you know, am I being over rewarded, under rewarded, or about right? And when you feel like you're being under rewarded, you're frustrated and you're unhappy and you're angry. And what are you going to do about that? Well, there's a number of things you can do. You can directly bitch and tell the people you're being under rewarded, but the truth is they're rewarding you the way they're rewarding you because if that's how they value you. And so it's unlikely that bitching about it is going to actually cause anything to change. So really the deal is, hey, you've got to figure out, do they have a point? Is it that you're not bringing enough to the table for them to act more like they value you more? Or is it that you're in the wrong place? And so, you know, this is the calibration process is an essential process. Yeah, and the feelings of anger are an essential uncomfortable experience that are there to warn you of the possibility that you're being exploited. It isn't that you are being exploited. It's the possibility that you're being exploited. And so your job then, instead of sitting there and suffering, is to actually go and discover whether or not that is likely to be true. And that's to help clarify and calibrate your mind so that your mind is in a position to make a better decision for your interests.
Fascinating. All right. Well, our next question is from a listener who has a unique situation. Dr. Lyle, my mother is in her late 50s, no job, no hobby, no friends, no pets, and not much to do at home since I'm the only child and I went off to university and only spend some weekends at home. She is no doubt introverted and low in openness, but I still feel that she could be much more productive and happier. Yet I fail to nudge her in any direction. I've given up the job angle since her cost benefit is admittedly awful. She has no skills and even full-time could only earn a fraction of what my dad does. But I also can't shake off the feeling that she may be all kinds of ego-trapped and she has certainly let life go by. Can I do anything other than be kind to her and mind my own business?
It's a really good question. And the answer is that you're doing what you can do, which is to ask somebody like me who might actually know how to get some leverage over your mom's psychology. So you're doing exactly the right thing by asking. Now, the problem here, there's a multitude of issues here, but this person is right to think that this is not an ideal situation for the mom's happiness. And we don't know all of the reasons, but certainly one of the reasons is probably because of low confidence that she could go out in the marketplace and have any success at all. And also the amount of money that she would be paid would be so small relative to the husband's that it actually feels insulting and highlights the fact that she's not that valuable relative to the husband. So that's a potential source of embarrassment. And the and also this is absolutely an ego trap, where this is essentially an incompetent animal. Now, a competent animal is one that is capable of doing what it needs to survive, which means it needs to obtain energy in order to pay for the energy that it expends in getting energy. So if you can't feed yourself, you're in trouble. And so this individual is simply essentially a parasite. And she has a parasitic relationship to the husband. And she's not, she's an incompetent animal that for a multitude of reasons is intimidated or lazy. Absolutely, we would expect that the net result of this would be that what's sitting under here is fear and depression. So, I could be wrong. It could be that there's somebody that's fundamentally lazy and feels very secure and has no problem in a parasitic situation, et cetera, et cetera. That's possible. But it doesn't sound like it, and it sounds like our questioner is picking up all kinds of cues that indicate that this is essentially an animal in inner turmoil. Now, so what do we have? The biggest fundamental problem that we have is the ego trap, because there's such a thing as unskilled labor, and there's unskilled labor these days in the Western world in perfectly benign circumstances that aren't embarrassing, and you're not down on the factory floor, you know, I don't know, digging cockroaches out of almond roca cans, that you don't have to do this, that instead you can live, you know, you can work in a nice little Hallmark store and sell Hallmark cards and ring up stuff at the register, and they'll pay you $12 an hour to do that. Now, what we need to do is we need to have the person out of the ego trap, because we suspect a big ego trap. In other words, it would be expected that she could get a job, but she may not believe that she could get a job. It's expected that the job would pay, you know, some decent wage, and she's not confident that that's true. So as a result, what we need to do is we would need to try to nudge her out of the ego trap by having the expectations be way lowered. And the way that I would talk to her would be the following. I would say, you know, when I see you just, you know, without any employment, so instead of without a job, which is a little lower brow word and a little more pejorative, like you don't have a job, it's like without employment, that's a little classier, okay? So when I see, you know, you without employment, it just makes me feel like you might be happier if you had something. And, you know, I'm not talking about working full time or anything like this, but just a part-time job, part-time position somewhere might, you know, I know that I'd feel a little lousy if I didn't earn any money, and it might feel good just to do something. And you might not like it, and maybe you won't like it. Probably you won't, and it's probably not worth it. But you might learn something in the process, and you might like it. Who knows? So it might be worth an experiment, just, you know, for once, just to try it and see what happens. And heck, you know, maybe there isn't a decent job around, but you could try looking at a few places, and who knows, maybe something will happen. So by framing it in this way, it's an experiment, probably won't like it, probably not worth it, you know, probably won't pay you decently, but hey, it's just an adventure. And, you know, who knows what, you might like it, who knows. By keeping the bar super low, you might just tickle the other side of the ego trap. The person has a decision node in their head, in the programming of their brain, and it says compete or don't compete. And under the not compete, there's the reason why the node shifts to not compete is the cost benefit says don't bother. Okay, and there are several possible reasons why it would go to that node. One of them is don't compete because we don't have the chops to compete in that arena. Number two is that I may not be able to be as competitive as everybody thinks I can be, and therefore the right decision is to not compete. That's the ego trap. So this person is probably in a pretty substantial ego trap, and so the way we get them out of the ego trap is by communicating as part of the social world that our expectations are actually quite a bit lower for that individual than they thought that we would be. And we act very unashamed about it. Like, hey, I know if it was me, I would just want something part-time. Just who knows, I just might run an experiment and see. I probably wouldn't like it, but I might. And, you know, I might not get a job, but I might. And by having it be, maybe I will, maybe I won't, maybe I can, maybe I can't, maybe I'll like it, maybe I won't like it, who the hell knows? By having that notion of, but something good might happen, that is bringing the bar down very far, that the person may be now willing to make a few little efforts in that direction. And if they make a little effort in that direction and they manage to get a little part-time job at the Hallmark store, that could be a very anxiety-provoking process for that individual and exhilarating within a week. Okay? And literally you turn that life around and give that life the sense that it's a competent animal. So that's how I would do that. That's a little fine-grained analysis of some of the words we use and the tactics we use to try to nudge somebody out of the ego trap.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, Dr. Lyle, our next question.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle, on a recent episode, you said, one thing that worries me based on the past decade is that the media's and politicians' abilities to manipulate and exploit human psychology seems to have grown faster than people's ability to see through said manipulation. Do you also see this trend, and how do you think it will continue?
I don't know. It sounds like somebody unhappy with the election, maybe. I don't know. The the truth is that the politicians, amazingly, are almost entirely irrelevant. And so this is a beautiful thing, that it doesn't matter what they say and who believes what they say, and whether or not they've got slick performances that wind up, you know, causing people to think this or think that. It's all quite irrelevant. What goes on in the political sphere in the United States and in most Western democracies is almost irrelevant. In other words, what you have is you've got opponent processes going on with different factions. And so as a result of that, they're like a bunch of very strong people in a long-term tug of war, and there's 40 people on that have the rope on either side. So you can imagine when one person gets tired and they tug a little bit to the left, the people on the left are getting all excited because they just gained a yard. But the truth is that this thing is like 80, you know, it's a 100-yard rope. So you gained 1 yard, but you're not even close to beating us. And it's going to turn out that, you know, a little while later, somebody on the left side is going to get tired, or they're going to get a cramp in their leg, and they're going to have to sit out, and then it's going to get pulled back to the right. Okay, and this is where it sits. So, to my way of thinking, I really couldn't care less. It's all a very exciting. You have people on both sides of various equations, you know, basically feeling like the other side is completely, you know, dishonest and dangerous. And that's what everybody thinks. Everybody thinks the person on the other side is dishonest and dangerous. Okay, and the truth is, it's fine. That's why we have the brilliant checks and balances system that we have. I can't even believe that these guys came up with this, you know, a couple hundred years ago, but they did. They came up with it, and everybody's blaming Big Louie. The executive branch blames the legislative branch. They blame the the executive branch and the judicial system sits around, you know, in the middle of this. Everybody's got somebody to blame, and there's checks and balances all over the place. It's grand. Enjoy it. Okay. Your job is to enjoy your life. Read How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Harry Brown and start enjoying your existence and realizing there's no burning issue that the world is going to overlook that's going to cause the destruction or massive disaster in your life. It's not going to happen. So the world is you're tremendously safe. You're sitting inside an extraordinarily free country. Make the most of your life experience. And for God's sakes, don't waste your time worrying about the fact there's people you disagree with that are dishonest and dangerous. Because it doesn't matter. Okay. All right. Let's go on.
Yeah, fascinating. I think of the founding fathers who, you know, created this constitution. I thought, you know, how conscientious could they have been that they didn't want to get exploited? How open they had to be at that time to craft such a document?
Really, just an amazing. I know almost nothing of American political history. Fortunately, I've got a good friend who knows a great deal about this, and one day she's going to sit down and educate me about this. About this process, about how this happened, but the truth is it's extraordinary. I look at the results of it, and I shrug my shoulders and roll my eyeballs at the fear and exhilaration of anything happening politically. So it's like a big, strong, unbelievably well-built ship, and it's not sinking. Okay. And when it runs into a few crabs and bumps into a shark, it doesn't even feel it. Okay, so that's where the United States political system is today, and that's where it's been for a long time. And that's where it's going to stay. Yeah.
And that's where it's going to stay.
Right.
I like it.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Lyle, I think we want to take one more.
Nah, let's not take one more. We'll save it for next week.
Okay, yeah, this one's probably going to be a longer answer. So we'll save this one for next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. In case people are wondering, we now have a voicemail box that you can call in. It's an attended voicemail box for listeners who maybe can't call live during the show and maybe want to leave a message. And the number for that is – oh, shoot, I lost it here. The number for that is – dang it, here it is. I guess that should have the number ready.
Sharp
when I
start
talking.
Sharp.
Yeah, it's 714-900-2601. So if you guys need to leave a message, want to give us a comment, give us a call there. Dr. Lyle, thanks very much. We'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Absolutely. Pleasure, Nate. See you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.